Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So we'll be looking at 1 Samuel 18, verses 17 to 19 this evening. But before we do, we'll just go over a quick overview where we've got to this point. As you remember, 1 Samuel is all about this leadership void. Who is going to come and lead Israel in the right way? You know, we had this question right from the start that Hannah's prayer prayed that there would be one that would come who would hold the horn like the king. Who would be that king? The end of Judges, there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And then Samuel comes up, and Samuel is a man after God's own heart. He serves God faithfully by proclaiming his word, even in difficult situations. But Samuel's there, and they see this rise and this triumph where they truly are what Israel is called to be, set apart, worshiping Yahweh, the one true living God. They've put away all their other gods, and they finally do this in chapter 7. Chapter 8 comes around, and then they ask for a king. Samuel wasn't enough. They wanted a king. So they got a king. They got exactly what they wanted, a king like other nations in Saul. And Saul kind of had some good moments, but overall, just real rapid decline we saw of Saul. We've pointed out this throughout, but in chapter 15, finally, he did not do what God had commanded. He did exactly what they warned in the end of Judges. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now they have a king in Israel, but he still did what was right in his own eyes. So chapter 15 ends with Saul being rejected, and Saul left there with the corner robe of Samuel's robe. This is what's left of his kingdom. This is what will be of your kingdom. It will be torn from your hands. And then chapter 16 comes around and we meet young David. Young David in the fields, finally anointed as king. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon David. And not only the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, we see the sign of that affirmation, with the sign confirming that, with him playing the music, but also him defeating Goliath in chapter 17. So David has come along. He's defeated Goliath. He's helped lead Israel to victory. Who is going to fill this leadership void? And in chapter 18, there's a slight shift. David still is predominant, but Saul kind of comes, it turns back around to Saul. But this is still focusing on David. David is the person that we're seeing the important thing. And this is what frustrates Saul. Everyone loves David, but Saul does not love David. David's that leader, although Saul still sits on the throne. And we saw Jonathan commit himself, the prince, to the throne. Jonathan then commits himself and follows David as a leader. The women at the gate with their tambourines were following and loving David as a leader. Israel and Judah loved David. This raises this envy and jealousy in Saul, this thing that we see in Saul, just like Cain. He was jealous of his brother Abel. And this raises up not to do the right thing, not to be a better king, not to follow God's voice, but to try and wipe out David. And now David is Saul's enemy. He's a leader to everyone else, but he is an enemy to Saul. And we're going to continue this, and this chapter still focuses on everyone loving David and Saul being envious of David. And we're going to see this. And the first thing we'll see is Merab in verses 17 to 19. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter Merab, and I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I? And who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be a son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. So here's this promise that is given by Saul. If you remember back to chapter 17, when David comes into the camp, he says, what is the reward, basically, for killing killing Goliath? What does this happen. And they turn around, the people turn around and tell David that he gets three things. The king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches. He will give him his daughter, and he will make his father's house free in Israel. Here's the promise which Saul had given to the person who defeats Goliath. And now Saul is going and fulfilling his word. But in what he's really just fulfilling one of these parts, right? These three things that he has promised: to enrich him, to give him his daughter, and then to free his house. Now, I'm not sure about you, but maybe this is a political move, a little bit of a politician putting forward a word and just kind of fulfilling that when it sees fit for him. In this case, he fulfills his second promise. He'll give him his daughter. But the reason isn't because he turns back and says, I will do this because I promise to do that. I want to be a man of my word. The reason he wants to do this is it works in his favor. And he'll go out into battle. He'll fight against the Philistines. So Saul comes forward and says, here is my elder daughter, Merab. And he says, I will give her to you for a wife. But he says, only if you will be, there's conditions attached to this. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. So, what does valiant mean? A son of valor is maybe another way to put it. Now, this is the same word that is used in 1 Samuel 9 when we first introduced to Saul. In chapter and verse 1, it says that there's a man of valor, man of wealth, which is Saul. This word can mean strength, strong, or wealth, well off. In 1 Samuel 14, 52, he says he was fighting hard against the Philistines in the days of Saul, and Saul saw any strong man or a valiant man and attached himself, and he attached to himself. That here's his philosophy on how to be a good king is to get other people to come in and fight your battles. You know, this is somewhat of a true case, right? But if you're a weak king, if you're not an obedient king, surrounding yourself with good people is good, but you're not really dealing with the issue of yourself. You're just trying to cover that up. We saw this with a lot of the battles, right? Jonathan goes in and defeats the garrison of the Philistines. It wasn't Saul's idea, it was garrison. It was Jonathan's idea. So he says, you want to be valiant? Be valiant for me. Now, order is important. The first thing that he is concerned about, and we see this time and time again, and we will continue to see this time and time again, Saul is not worried about the Lord. He's not worried about Israel. He's not worried about the Lord's people. He's first and foremost worried about his kingdom and himself and his own self. He's not worried about the Lord or the Lord's battles. Although he says, fight the Lord's battles, this is one of the only times, really, that Saul uses the word the Lord in his talking. It's very frequent that, you know, when David talks, he talks about the Lord a lot. When Saul talks, it's very absent. And you see this clear thing. But here he says, will you fight the Lord's battles? But this is why they actually called Saul to be king. Saul was to be king to fight the Lord's battles for the people. In 1 Samuel 8:20, it says that you might be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. This is why they wanted a king. One of the reasons they wanted a king was that they would have a king who would go fight the Lord's battles for them. But here, Saul is again using it for his own advantage to be able to get his what he wants. But underlying all of this is Saul's reasoning behind this. Not to bring God glory, not to look after the people, not to fulfill what he had promised he would said he would do. The reasoning behind it is, let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. Clearly, he didn't succeed well at throwing two spears at David. We'll see him again try this again, but Saul thinks, well, why not just send him into battle? And we know David does exactly the same thing with Uriah, that David is also a sinful man. But he did it all because back in verse 9, you remember in 18 verse 9 when the women were there and they were saying that Saul had struck down his thousands, but David was with his 10,000s. He was very angry and it displeased him because what they had said. And then Saul eyed David from that day on. And remember that word eyed is not necessarily just he looked at him. It gets in our English translation a little bit, but he sinned against him. He committed iniquity against him. He envied what David had and what the Lord had given David and wasn't grateful for what he had. We looked at that last time about envy. But from this day on, he really was just using any situation he could to be able to get at David. Again, Saul doesn't go back and repent. Saul doesn't turn to the Lord. Saul doesn't try and work out why he's not a very good king. He doesn't turn away. He uses everything for his own response to be able to eye it, to be able to get back at David. Again, what has David done in this situation? We know David is a sinner. We have Psalm 51, which proves this. From his youth, he was a sinner. In my womb, my mother conceived me in sin. But in this situation, the question keeps on coming up, what did David do wrong? And David is just doing what the Lord has called him to do, but Saul is against him. So what is David's response in all of this when he's offered his Saul's daughter, Merab? His response is humility. We'll see this time and time again. But when Samuel was first comes up, when Saul first comes up, he questions whether he is going to be a good king. And he turns back and says, "Am I not a Benjamite, the least of the tribes of Israel? What is my clan, the humblest of all the clans in the tribe of Benjamin? Why then have you spoken to me this way?" Where Moses said the same thing, right? In Exodus chapter 3, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring out the children of Egypt?" But David's response of humility, Saul has had some humility. I would say that it's either fear in chapter 9 or it was true humility in chapter 9, but it seems to have turned that his humility is not humble. You know, if you truly are humble, when people talk about singing thousands and then tens of thousands, you're fine with this. You're fine understanding that you're not the strongest person, that you can't win all the battles. Yet here Saul is, he's worried about this. But David's response to Saul in verse 18 is, "Who am I?" Think about this, a musician, a shepherd. "Who am I that I might be the son of a king? Who are my relatives? You know, in my family," we've gone through this in the book of Ruth, "my great-grandmother or great-great-grandmother, a Moabite, Perez, the son of Tamar, scarlet thread on the arm, the firstborn after Zerah. Perez ran to the finish line, though. But who am I that I might be chosen for this? What about my father's clan?" You think about Bethlehem. We really know Bethlehem as a great city because that's where Jesus was born. That's where David is from. But besides that, it was not a big place. "Who's my clan in Israel? You know, Obed. We're bread suppliers. You know, what important place do we have? And all this, that I should be the son-in-law to the king." So, here's the humility. But ultimately, the plan failed. It wasn't Merab that David married. Merab married another man. We don't get any details about how this happened. It seems like it's quite an abrupt thing. But in this culture, you'd have to assume that Saul is responsible for giving his daughter's hand in marriage. So he made this promise. He pretends that this promise is to fulfill what he said. And then he goes back on his word, maybe because there's a political gain in having Merab marry this other man. But ultimately, we understand that it's God's providence. That God orchestrates all things that come to pass even this occasion in verse 19, that Merab is now wed to another. This is all God's plan. So it's Merab is not there. So now Saul turns to his next daughter, Michal. And Michal is there. So in verses 20 to 23. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul that the thing pleased him. And Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she might be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then become the king's son-in-law. And then in verse 23, and Saul's servant spoke those words in the ears of David. And David said, does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation? So again, this theme that has come up in this passage is a love for David. Now, Saul loved David back in chapter 16 when he played for him at the end of chapter 16. Saul loved David, but this is turned. But then you see Jonathan loving David, the start of chapter 18. Israel and Judah loving David in 18, verse 16. Michal loving David in 18, 20. And now even Saul's servants love David. And again, we get this glimpse of what Saul is thinking, his response in what he is thinking in verse 21 is, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So here he has a two-pronged attack now against David. Mirror was just that the hand of the enemies would be upon him, but now with Michal, it is that he would be a snare for him. Now, in Psalm 106, verse 36, it says, they served their idols, which became a snare to them. It's this kind of track, right? Not much of a hunt or anything like this, but the purpose of a snare is to trap someone, to get them in a situation where they cannot free themselves. There's maybe this, they go down this track or something like this, and eventually they get caught in this snare where they're not able to free themselves. And this is Saul's plan. If he marries my daughter Michal, then finally he'll be trapped. There'll be no way out. And it's common in the Bible to speak of idols taking Israelites and turning them away from worshiping God. This is what he wants his daughter to be able to do. So he wants her to be a snare, but also, again, that the hand of the Philistines would be against them. This is his plan. We saw this in Merab. If we send him out into battle time and time again, then they will he will suffer the hand of the Philistines. This terminology, hand of the Philistines, comes often, especially in the book of Judges, and we've even seen it in Samuel. In Judges chapter 10, it says that the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines. And in 1 Samuel 7, verse 3, it says, Samuel said to all the house of Israel, if you're returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away your foreign gods, the Ashtaroth, from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord, and serve him only. And he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. We see the Lord delivering them into it, and then he delivers them out of it. And now Saul just thinks he can orchestrate it a similar way. He seeks somewhat to take a place of God, but he also tries to have his plan to remove David. So Saul's servants go and talk to David and ask him if he would be up for this. Maybe he sends his servants because he's questioned the first time. You told me you'd do this before. What's going to happen again? You think this might be a valid response, but his response, again, is humility. David doesn't seem to have false humility. He has true humility. Does it seem a little thing to you to become the king's son-in-law, since I am, one, a poor man and have no reputation? Now, what did Saul promise to the person who defeats the Goliath? Riches, money, and set his father's house free. Now, it doesn't seem Saul has fulfilled any of these. David's still a poor man. He has no reputation. Although everyone was singing his name at the gates, he still seems himself as a small little clan and a small person. But we saw that weakness in chapter 17, didn't we, when he was defeating Goliath. He didn't see himself as a great warrior. He knew who he was. He knew he was a shepherd. And he knew the Lord had prepared him as a shepherd and that the Lord would deliver him. Matthew Henry notes, it well becomes us. However, God has advanced us always to have low thoughts of ourselves. And if David thus magnified the honor of being son-in-law to the king, how shall we magnify the honor of being sons, not in law, but in gospel, to the King of Kings? So he turns this and says, David's humbled by being asked to be the son-in-law to the king. Are we really humbled when we think about being sons to the King of Kings? James says that God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So we have these reasons that he gives, that he's poor. Now, in Nathan's parable, the rich man and the poor man taking the sheep. Remember that this probably has this connection when he gives this parable of the rich man taking the poor man. David might be able to think back on that time when he was a poor man, and what that would have been like to lose one of his sheep to a king, to Saul, at this point. And then also to have no reputation. Proverbs 12:19 says, better to be lowly and have a servant than to play the great man and lack bread. Better to be lowly and have a servant than to play the great man and lack bread. And here he has the honest reputation, that he has no reputation for him. So now he comes with the marriage gift. Now, it's common in our culture, right, that someone gets married. When I was asking my father-in-law to marry my beautiful wife, I asked him what the dowry was. He had to ask again. That wasn't an Australian cultural thing. But it's common to be able to bring wedding gifts. Now, in this culture, it seems a bit of a strange thing to do for his request, but he almost comes back, how can I earn this? How can I earn this? So in 1 Samuel 18, 24 to 30, we find out about the wedding gifts. And the servants of Saul told him, thus and so did David speak. Then Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines, and when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law before the time had expired. David rose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter, Michal, for a wife. And when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the command of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, that his name was highly esteemed. They come out with this bride price, this dowry, and he says, just a simple thing, 100 foreskins to avenge the king's enemies. And again, Saul's thoughts in all of this was that he might have David fall in battle trying to get this thing. Notice during this time that the focus is really on Saul and what Saul thinks, what Saul does, his actions. But yet we see the predominance of David. Even when Saul is trying to orchestrate all things to be able to get rid of David, that seems to put more focus on David. The more he tries to get rid of him, the more he is driven to the center, and people love him. And so he asked David, and David was pleased to be the king's son-in-law. He feels like maybe he's earned it to be able to do this. So he goes out, and it pleased him in verse 26. He's happy to be able to go do this. So he goes on, he takes his men with him, and he kills 200. He asks for 100, and he goes and kills 200 of the Philistines, and he brings back their foreskins. Now, Saul wanted 100, thinking 100 men would be able to wipe David out. And David goes and takes 200, and it doesn't seem to have hurt David in any way. He's quite victorious over this. But in this verse 27, it's very rapid. There's a lot of thinking and planning going on in the end of chapter 18, but it's very, you know, what Saul's trying to do, what he's trying to accomplish. But in verse 27, there's five verbs that just happen very rapidly. They're vav consecutives, and, which, and. You know, we see this. And David's quite accomplished to what he does. So, again, did Saul's plan work? But Michael married David, but he still failed miserably because at the end, Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David. And Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. That right at the end, 16 verse 13, that Samuel anoints David and the Spirit of the Lord rushes upon him. And here is David in amongst these people, and he's been attacked. But even now, Saul can realize that the Lord is with David. Now again, when you're unregenerate, where I think Saul is, this doesn't change your posture, right? You still think you can win. You still think you can wipe him out. He's victorious not because David is amazing. He's weak. He's lowly. I think his humility is true. He doesn't think highly of himself, but the Lord is with him. This is why he's able to do and conquer all the Philistines. This is why he was able to conquer Goliath. The Lord was with him. But also Saul's daughter loved him. And now we have Saul's son, the heir to the throne, that loves David. All the people, the women at the gate, Israel and Judah loved David. Saul's servants loved David. And now his daughter Michal loves David. And what does this do to him? He was even more afraid. You see this progression right from chapter 18. David becomes more successful, more loved, and Saul becomes more consumed, more envious. He eyes David from that day on in verse 9. He was afraid of David. In verse 12, he stood in fearful awe of David in verse 15, and now he was even more afraid of David. This is the terminology and words which is used to the Philistines, which is used with Judah and Israel and Saul standing before Goliath. He was afraid of Goliath, and now he's afraid of David. He's fearful of him. Saul was David's enemy continually. You see this throughout the Bible, this seed theology, which is found in Genesis 3:15, that the seed of the serpent will be at war forever with the seed of the woman, the seed of promise. And here you see this in practice. You see the promise upon from Abraham. Abram in chapter 12 of Genesis, that I will bless you who bless you and dishonor you I will curse. And here we have that tension right here in Israel. God's people has this tension amongst themselves. Saul sits enthroned in Israel. He's rebelled against God. The kingdom is ripped from his hands. Yet he still sits enthroned. Now, what has David done wrong at this point? Nothing. You know, we realize that he's a sinner, that he's failed. But in the narrative, they don't bring to attention that at this point. Later, David will say of Saul, "Do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" Even with all this wrong done against him, he's still not willing to be able to take that line. He trusts in God. That in this instant, we need to stop and consider, this isn't a war between people outside of Israel. This is a war between people inside of Israel. A war between leaders inside of Israel. Now, if we're to take this and apply it to the church, that there might be times in the church where you might be wrongly accused or someone might have it against you and they want you out. They're not handling it in a godly manner. They're not turning and repenting. But yet, David in this line realizes that he does what he's called to do. He faithfully does it. He faithfully submits, knowing that God is in control. Now, that might not be the perfect scenario and situation. There might be times where you just think, okay, too many presbyteries where I've had spears thrown at me. This is unwise for me to be here. You know, maybe not literally physical spears, but there might be situations where you think it's just a wise thing to part from one another. But in all this situation, the inward focus and the inward conflict causes them not to focus on their outward means of what they're trying to do and accomplish. Israel's sent there to be a blessing to other nations, that other nations might be blessed. But the concern is about Saul, Saul, Saul. Not a concerned about how much has worship come up in this moment. How much does it go back to 1 Samuel 7, where worship was the key thing, serving God and God alone. So chapter 18 shows us mate, music, military, and marriage. Throughout this chapter, we've seen that it's centered around Saul's response to David. His envy growing in him more and more. Saul is the main person in this chapter. However, David is the one that consumes all of Saul's thoughts and his action. David is anointed the king of Israel. And we see that he often gets the last word. In verse 5, David was successful wherever Saul sent him. In verse 14, and David had success in all of his undertakings. In 15, and Saul saw that he had great success. His response is then fearful awe. In verse 30, that David had success more than all the servants of Saul. Not only did David have success, but the love of David grew throughout all this. Jonathan was knit to him as his own soul. We see this in verse 1 and then again in verse 3, that he loved him with his own soul. In verse 16, and all of Israel loved David. In verse 20, and Saul's daughter, Michal, loved David. Saul's servants loved David. And now Saul sees his own daughter loving David. But again, why does David have success? The reason why people love David, because he's having this success, because the Lord is with him. The anointing which happened in 16 verse 13, with the Spirit rushing upon him. David was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. In verse 14, David had success in all of his undertakings. Why? Because the Lord was with him. And again in verse 28, and Saul saw that the Lord was with David. Comforting thing that although he has Saul, a very strong man, against him, he has the Lord with him. even as a young man. He was recommended to Saul because people saw that the Lord was with him. It doesn't matter what he's doing, the Lord is with him. This causes him to have that success. He's playing music. The Lord is with him. When he's in battle, the Lord is with him. David's success is really not about his own qualities, but because the Lord is with him. He could have been walking around with a t-shirt that says, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." Not in a different way that we might necessarily think this, that I can be whoever I want to be. God has called me to this task, and he will strengthen me to be able to carry out that task. The Lord is with me, and he will see me through it. But the reason why we have this verse in verse 13 in Philippians 4:13, Paul just before in verse 12 says, "I know how to be brought low and how to abound in any and every circumstance. I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need." And he says, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." In this situation, he has a great enemy. But even in this situation, he has an even greater God. Saul is consumed with David. This is not new for Saul. Not that he was a nice guy beforehand and something changed, but it shows his character from the start. We've noted this before. He was the People's Choice Award. They got exactly what they wanted. We notice these things as we're going through these small little hints that we get. But ultimately, people in these situations, it's nothing that happened to him that made him change. This is how he always was. And it's just when you're put in that limelight, that spotlight, that you don't want to lose what you've got. Saul never obeyed God. He always did it his own way. His success was always from someone else, mainly his son Jonathan. Because why? Because the Lord was with him. And David is now Saul's enemy, because God is Saul's enemy. Saul is the seed of the serpent, like Cain, who murdered his brother out of envy. Saul wants to murder David. Not because David is evil or bad or dishonoring God, but the opposite. He wants to murder him because he is serving the Lord. He's honoring God. This is exactly what Jesus told the Pharisees, that they're just like their father Cain. John 8, he turns to them and says, "You are the father of the devil. Your will is not to do the father's desires. Your father is to do your father's desires. You've been a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in truth, because the truth is not in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and a father of lies. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me." That this is exactly what Saul is like. It's important in all of this to note that Saul's envy is towards David. Saul wants David dead. He wants to murder him. But yet, David in all of this remains upright in character. He remains loyal to God. And he remains committed to serving God wherever the Lord has placed him. And I think that's a great encouragement for us when we face these troubles and difficulties, whether it's in the church, whether it's outside the church, whether it's in our families or in our workplace. David is a great example in this moment to stay steadfast and loyal to God in how God has called us to. Even in Psalm 23, verse 4, we know this well. But even thinking about this in his current situation, we'll look at some psalms coming up where they're written in amongst this narrative. But you could even think, "I will walk through, even though I walk through the valley of shadow of death, I will fear no evil." And the reason he will fear no evil, for you are with me. And we see this in this passage. The Lord is with David. And he's able, through the Lord being with him, to be able to see him through. Chapter 18 is a depressing chapter, really, seeing the state which Israel is in. But yet the Lord is still working, even though when we turned in 1 Samuel, who is the priest? It is Eli. He doesn't serve God honorably. His sons dishonor God. They're foolish. They're worthless. Yet the Lord is still working and raising up a leader who will be able to lead Israel. And we see the exact same thing again. That Saul is on the throne. Saul is sitting there. But the Lord is still raising up and working in David to be able to raise up David that he might be able to sit on the throne and be able to honor God on the throne.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.